My name is Sean O'Keefe. I'm one of the Interactive Festival producers here at South by Southwest. I'm very honored to be with you here today. First, I would like to share a few quick updates before we begin. After the keynote in this very room, Biz Stone and Brian Sergitz will talk about content as a means for social change. And at 5 p.m., we'll have a special presentation from Sean Parker and a gentleman by the name of Al Gore. I think you might have heard of him. Today also marks the opening day of the South by Southwest Trade Show in Exhibit Hall 4. In addition to the over 300 amazing exhibitors showcasing their latest technologies, our friends at Payment One have a special happy hour event this afternoon beginning at 4, so make sure to catch that if you can. Speaking of happy hours, now that our weather modification technologies are back online, we're having a special tweet-up, drink-up party today from 6 to 7:30 in Palm Park, which is located on 3rd Street just east of the Convention Center, which is basically 100 yards or so that way. Make sure to also visit the park today for the second day of South SOS Craft Camp as well. And tonight, of course, there are a wide variety of networking events, from intimate receptions to packed concerts. See the Interactive Pocket Guide and South SOS Go app for all the possibilities there. And now a bit about our special guests. As one of the leading inventors of our time, Ray Kurzweil was the principal developer of the first CCD flatbed scanner, the first OmniFont optical character recognition, you guys better be taking notes, the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind, the first text-to-speech synthesizer, the first music synthesizer capable of recreating the grand piano and other orchestral instruments, and the first commercially marketed large vocabulary speech recognition. As the character Neo from The Matrix would say, whoa. But there's more. In 1999, he received the National Medal of Technology, the nation's highest honor in technology, from President Clinton in a White House ceremony. And in 2002, he was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. He has received 19 honorary doctorates and honors from 3 U.S. presidents. Ray has written 4 national best-selling books. The Age of Spiritual Machines has been translated into 9 languages and was the number 1 best-selling book on Amazon and Science. Ray's latest book, The Singularity is Near, was a New York Times bestseller and has been the number 1 book on Amazon in both science and philosophy. Whether we know it or not, from the technology that lives in our phones and gave birth to Siri, to the thousands of musicians who will perform later this week during the music festival, to the smartest young man on our interactive team who overcame severe dyslexia with Ray's own Kurzweil 3000 software, Ray has touched all of our lives. Ray will give some introductory remarks today and then have a conversation with another New York Times bestseller, Time Magazine writer and author Lev Grossman. I know many of you have read The Magicians and The Magician King, so we are absolutely thrilled to have Lev here today as well. There will be a Q&A today where rumor has it Ray and Lev will reveal the secret to immortality, so you'll definitely want to stick around for that. Ray and Lev will also be signing books upstairs directly after the keynote. So without further ado, I'm honored to present Lev Grossman and legendary visionary Ray Kurzweil.
Well, it's great to be with you. I've heard the buzz about South by Southwest for many years. I'm from the 60s generation. We sort of invented the counterculture, and I've always felt that the hippie movement morphed into the Silicon Valley movement, and it's very much a worldwide movement, as you can sense and feel here at this conference. What we see today is a democratization of innovation and creativity. So, I mean, Google was started by a couple of students with a late-night dorm room challenge about reversing the links on the internet. Facebook was started with $19,000 of capital and a couple of notebook computers. If any of you are thinking of starting a fashion line, you'll want to get Tavi Gevensen on your side. She makes and breaks fashion lines. She was on the cover of Vogue recently. She's 14. She started her blog when she was 11. You don't need millions of dollars. I know a lot of people here are very proud about their A rounds and so forth, but you can start world-changing revolutions really with the passion of your ideas and tools that everybody has. A kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more knowledge and information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. So it's a, and that democratization is fueled by the exponential growth of information technology, which I want to come back to. But I'm sure you're familiar with the television game Jeopardy. It's an answer in search of a question. So if the answer was the current president of the United States, the question would be, who is Barack Obama? Okay, so how about this answer? A long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. There's probably a few thousand people here, and nobody's got that. It's obviously a meringue. What is a meringue harangue? So Watson, that computer actually lives near here, got that correct in its televised competition against the best two Jeopardy players in the world, and Watson got a higher score than those two players combined. And I'll want to touch on the significance of it, but it addresses the issue of whether the progress we're making, the exponential progress, is just in hardware, because that's one of the criticisms that comes up. Oh, Kurzweil's right. Yeah, hardware has been progressing exponentially, but software is stuck in the mud. There's different ways to approach that, but in terms of qualitative, visceral reactions, Watson is very impressive because it's dealing with the subtleties and vagaries of human language. I made a prediction in the early 80s that a computer would take the World Chess Championship by 98, and I also predicted that when that happened, we would immediately dismiss chess as of being of any significance. And both of those things happened in 97. Kasparov was defeated by Deep Blue, and people immediately said, well, that's to be expected. Chess is a logic game, and computers are logic machines, and so obviously computers will ultimately do a better job. Computers will never be able to master the subtleties and vagaries of human language, metaphors, puns, similes, riddles, jokes. Well, that's exactly what Jeopardy is all about. That's one reason this is very significant. Now, some people misunderstand the nature of Watson. They think that all of its knowledge was hand-coded by the scientists. Okay, it does have to deal with the subtle language in these Jeopardy queries, which have metaphors and are, you know, pretty tricky examples of human language. But it got its knowledge about to come up with the correct response not by being hand-coded, but by actually sitting down, figuratively, and reading. It was actually 200 million pages of natural language documents, including all of Wikipedia. So, and it was able to master all that, remember it all. They're not orderly facts. I mean, if you read a Wikipedia article, it's all kinds of information presented in a hierarchical, ambiguous fashion, and it has mastered that enough to actually respond to the questions correctly and can call up any fact from those 200 million pages in 3 seconds. So it's quite impressive. People say, well, it doesn't really understand what it's doing because it's just using statistical analysis of language. That is misunderstood. It's actually building a hierarchy based on what it reads, and in that hierarchy are probabilities of what different clauses might mean. It turns out that's exactly how the human brain works. I'm finishing up a book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, and we do exactly the same thing with our neocortex. We build up this hierarchy of structures that have probabilities in them, and we actually approach something like Jeopardy or even holding a social conversation in the same way using this statistical information. If using statistical information about language does not represent true understanding, then humans don't have any true understanding either. Now, Watson actually is not operating at human levels, and you might say, well, then how did it get a higher score than the best two human players? It's because it can combine whatever level of understanding it has with a capability that computers have long exceeded us at, which is total recall, tremendous speed, being able to repeat the same thing over and over again, doing that in, massively parallel fashion, we're not unable to do that. So it can take its ability to read a natural language document and apply that to all of Wikipedia. You and I could read all of Wikipedia also. Actually figured out it would double in size by the time we're done. And we would have forgotten the first three quarters of it by the time we're done. So it is a very remarkable combination. But in my view, the advent of this kind of AI, and we are in that period already, is basically enhancing who we are. And a lot of attention is paid to the idea of merging with this technology. I think it's actually whether or not this is inside my body or outside is a distinction without a difference. The size of technology is shrinking at an exponential rate. This is actually thousands of times more powerful than the computer I used when I was an undergraduate, and it's about 100,000 times smaller. It's millions of times cheaper. That's a several billion-fold increase in the amount of computation and communication per dollar. We'll do that again in 25 years. This will be the size of a blood cell. It will be another billion times more powerful per dollar. Every step along the way creates new entrepreneurial opportunities, which this crowd, you know, very much jumps on, and you can see the fervent of, you know, new opportunities from the latest turn of the screw of what I call the law of accelerating returns. So let me step through this with you. I don't have a lot of time. We want to have time for a dialogue with Lev and with you. This is what I wanted to cover today. Any questions on any of this? Well, very quickly, this was the first exponential graph I came up with in the early 1980s, 81. I was looking for a way to predict technology because the key to being successful as an inventor and an entrepreneur, or really pretty much anything in life, whether you're pursuing a career or a romance, is timing. So I wanted to see if I could anticipate where technology will be, and made a surprising discovery. If you measure the basic fundamental measures of information technology, any information technology, they follow very predictable trajectories, belying the common wisdom that you can't predict the future. So I had this graph up through 1980 and 81. By the way, this is a logarithmic scale, so every level on this graph is 100,000 times greater than the level below it. So even through 1980, this represented trillions-fold increase since the 1890 American census. As of today, it's several billion times progress since I was a student. But look at how smooth a trajectory that is. One of the criticisms, exponential growth can't go on forever. That's true for specific paradigms. So there were shrinking vacuum tubes in the 1950s. Finally, that came to an end. They couldn't do that anymore. It just went on to another paradigm, transistors, and then chips and Moore's Law. And Moore's Law will come to an end around 2020. We'll go on to the sixth paradigm of three-dimensional computing. But the remarkable thing here is, look at how smooth and predictable a trajectory this is. I actually plotted that curve in 1981 through 2050, and as of now, you know, around 2012, we're very much on that trajectory that I plotted 30 years ago. So this has been very predictive. Here's a graph that was in Lev Grossman's cover story on the singularity, and which is basically the outgrowth of the law of accelerating returns. And your graphics department wanted to put a particular computer they were interested in on the graph. I didn't know if it would end up on the curve or not. I knew it wouldn't be above the curve because I'd be giving the computer away, but could be below the curve. Sometimes things come out that are not cost-effective, but it's right on the curve. This has been a very predictive phenomenon. It's not just computers. On the right there is the trajectory of the number of bits we move around wirelessly in the world. So a century ago, that was Morse code over AM radio. Today, it's 4G networks. Again, that's trillions-fold increase. Every level on that graph is 1,000 times greater than the level below it. But look at how smooth a trajectory that is, which is surprising when you consider all the news and events that come out of, you know, new auctions of spectrum and multi-billion-dollar companies going bankrupt. Not to mention World War I and World War II and the Cold War and the Great Depression. You'd think this would be a very unpredictable phenomenon, but it's amazing how smooth it is. A very important area is biology, health and medicine, which was not an information technology up until just recently. But now that we've collected the genome, this has become an information technology. And that, by the way, was a very good example of exponential growth. Halfway through the project, the skeptics were going strong, saying, I told you this wasn't going to work. You're 7 years into this 15-year project, you finished 1% of the project. 7 years, 1%, it's going to take 700 years, like we said. My reaction was, no, we're almost done. Once you hit 1%, you're only seven doublings from 100%. It continued to double every year. It was done a year ahead of schedule. And every other aspect of biology is scaling up exponentially. Maybe we'll get into more discussion about that. But how long do you go without updating the software on your devices? This is probably updating itself now as I speak. But we're walking around with outdated software in our bodies, and it's not a metaphor. We have 23,000 little software programs called genes. They're not written in C++. I think they're written in COBOL. But one of those little programs says, hold on to every calorie, because the next hunting season may not work out so well. That's the fat insulin receptor gene. That was turned off in animal experiments, and these animals ate ravenously and remained slim and lived 20% longer, and they're working with Johnson Diabetes Center, working with a drug company on that. That's just one of the 23,000 genes we'd like to consider changing. There's a lot going on with stem cells. We can get into more of that, but the point is that health and medicine is now an information technology. Therefore, it will be subject to this law of accelerating returns. It's approximately doubling in power and capability and bandwidth and price performance every year. Therefore, these technologies will be 1,000 times more powerful in 10 years, 1,000,000 times more powerful in 20 years, and it will be a very different era. Internet data traffic, same thing. Early 80s, I had the first few points on that left-hand graph, which is a logarithmic scale. It's called the ARPANET. I projected a worldwide web connecting hundreds of millions of people by the late 90s, and people thought that was crazy when the entire American defense budget could only tie together a few thousand scientists. But that's what happened. The graph on the right is the same data, only seen on a linear scale, and that's how we experience the world. So to the casual observer, it looked like the World Wide Web came out of nowhere. But you could see it coming, and you could plan your next venture for it by looking at these exponential trends. The world of physical things is becoming information technology. That's an actual violin that was printed out on a three-dimensional printer. That's a whole emerging industry. The scale of precision is improving at an exponential rate of 100 in 3D volume per decade. The costs are coming down rapidly. The range of materials is expanding. That's an actual violin that was printed out. Someone printed out an airplane and flew in it. One module at a time and snap them together. That's how you use three-dimensional printers to print out big things. At Singularity University, which is this pin, we have a project to use three-dimensional printers to print out high-quality, low-cost housing for the developing world. Again, one Lego module at a time. That's another technology that will change the world. We're already starting to put blood cell-sized devices in the bloodstreams of animals. And this will be a mainstream technology in 20 years. The brain is another area where we are scaling up exponentially. I have a book coming out on that, and 11 I might talk more about that. But the spatial resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. The amount of data we're getting is doubling every year. The scale and precision of brain simulations is doubling. In this book, I will describe actually one mechanism in the neocortex that allows us to recognize patterns and deal with language and recognition of concepts, all the way from primitive things like the crossbar and a capital A up to irony and humor and loving sentiments and so on. So let me just show you this one graph because I'm already over my time. But there's one big issue. Is this good or bad? This crowd is unusually optimistic. I talk to lots of groups that are not so optimistic and think the world's going to hell in a handbasket. I would say the reason for that has to do with that you guys in the press are doing a great job, and this is a good thing, but it's sometimes misconstrued, at making us aware of what's wrong with the world. So when there's a battle in Fallujah or a medical crisis in Nigeria, we're there and we experience it. That was not the case in the past. We have much better knowledge of what's wrong. But here I have dozens of these graphs. Let's just look at a couple of things. Health and wealth over the last 200 years. The x-axis is per capita income in these different countries. Each circle is a country. The big red circle is China. On the y-axis, it's longevity, which was in the 20s and 30s in 1800, which is what you're looking at. Worldwide average, 37. So what happened over the last 200 years? Well, a few countries were experimenting with the Industrial Revolution, and there was a little bit of ferment. That picked up steam in the late 19th century. But as we get to the 20th century, you'll see a wind moving all of these countries towards the upper right-hand corner of the graph. The have-have-not divide remains, but at the end, the countries that are worst off are far better off than the countries that were best off at the end of the process. And I shouldn't say end of process, because the process has hardly ended. In fact, it's picking up speed with all the innovation represented in this room, fueled by this ongoing exponential growth. Education, same thing. Here, years of schooling has tripled over the last half century in the developing world, doubled in the developed world. There's a have-have-not divide, but both are moving in the right direction. So, well, can't get back to that graph, but I was going to show you the progression of longevity, which has gone from 20 1,000 years ago, 37 in 1800. If you can launch that graph. It was 48 in 1900, and it's pushing 80. This is from the linear progression of health and medicine before health and medicine was an information technology. Now that it is, it's going to progress exponentially. These technologies, as I mentioned, will be a million times more powerful within two decades. So if you can hang in there, we may get to experience the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Ray. That was fantastic. I feel augmented already.
We coordinated our clothes before we came out this morning.
Yeah. So just... to back up a little bit, you talked about Watson some, and you mentioned your iPhone a bit. Can we talk about Siri a little bit? Because that's an AI that a lot of us have had some up-close and personal interactions with. What do you think of Siri, and what do you think its significance is in terms of the landscape of AI and the progress?
Well, I'm proud of Siri. Major components of it came from Nuance, which I founded as Kurzweil Computer Products. And the speech recognition goes back to the speech recognition I developed in the 80s and 90s. And I think it's a real important, amazing threshold that people are talking to their computers. And so I ask people about it, and very often they complain, well, it didn't quite understand me last night, and reminds me of the joke of this woman whose dog plays chess, and people say, aren't you amazed your dog can play chess? And she goes, yeah, but his end game isn't very good. So computers are beginning to understand natural language. Watson does an even more amazing job. We can't afford to put the computational capacity of Watson to every Siri request or every Google request. But that's coming because of this exponential growth, and you will see natural language take a stronger and stronger role. And Siri's only going to get better, and it's really pretty good considering it's a first-generation product. And it shows computers beginning to understand natural language. Turing, in 1950, based his test, the Turing test, to ascertain the level of intelligence of a computer based on human language. If you can basically be indistinguishable from a human based on just on natural language, you're operating, that computer would be operating at human levels, according to Turing. And I think that idea has held up well.
So the Turing test, is that still the benchmark for recognizing self-awareness in a computer? Of course, when it happens, someone, meaning everybody, is just going to say, wow, that's a great conversation simulating app you've got on your phone there, but to say that it's sentient is just bizarre. What will it take to force people to recognize a computer as a person?
There's certainly been a lot of literature, and I've written a little of it, about the Turing test and its significance. And I would say of all the different proposals, it's still the one that has the most credibility. It will be an enormous threshold. However, it's not clear-cut. He didn't define it very well. Mitch Kapor and I have a bet as to whether or not a computer will pass the Turing test by 2029. We spent 6 months defining Turing's rules and came up with a pretty conservative set of rules. There's a Loebner competition every year, and everybody gets a score. There's humans playing and computers, different chatbots. They all get a score as to how human they are. So the humans are all up here. Occasionally you get a human that's not very good. The computers are inching up. Just looking at the speed of that trajectory, you'd get support for my date of 2029. So you asked whether that would be a benchmark for self-awareness. I talk about that in my new book. First of all, it'll be a fuzzy threshold because as soon as it's passed, people will debate whether or not it really was a valid test. I'll probably reject the first such reports as not being really strict enough. My view is that, there's a lot of theories. It's got to be quantum computing in order to have consciousness and so on, which are all, I think, leaps of faith. I believe that people will accept an entity as conscious and as a person if it seems that way. And in other words, if they are indistinguishable from humans. They may also be able to do other things. Computers already do lots of things we can't do. But if they can, in fact, convince us that they have the complexity of thought and the subtleties of reactions that humans do, we will come to accept them as humans. That's my prediction, and that's also my own personal philosophical leap of faith on that issue.
Where do you think it's going to come from? I always assume, I look at Siri, and it's a little bit of a toy, and Watson has impressive, but has obviously a great deal of public relations value for IBM. Where is the serious progress going to come from? I assume it's going to come from academia, something like the Blue Brain Project in Switzerland. Is that where the real action is happening?
I think the biggest push is the commercial value of computers that have more and more intelligence. Last time I checked, Google was doing pretty well, and it's doing things with word sequences. I mean, it is doing what people attribute to Watson, which is dealing with sequences of words. Watson actually is understanding what those sequences mean in terms of concepts to be able to match it against concepts that it's read. It will be of tremendous value for search engines, for example, or any other technology that searches through all this vast amount of knowledge we have to have an understanding of human knowledge. As we go through this decade, search engines aren't going to wait to be asked. They'll be listening in on your conversation with your permission and seeing, okay, he could use this little piece of information. That'll pop up in your visual field of view. Our screen will be, our visual field of view with augmented reality. Google's, in fact, coming out with augmented reality glasses. Mm-hmm. And so things will pop up saying, okay, he's trying to find the name of this actress, or here's a piece of information that would support the argument he's making, and it'll just pop up, and you'll get used to getting this kind of help as from an intelligent friend. The ability of a system to do that is going to be greatly enhanced by understanding natural language.
But they're not going to judge us, are they?
Are
they going to judge us for our search terms?
Well, it's hard to avoid making judgments. that making judgments is very much at the top level of our neocortex. Our neocortex is organized in a vast hierarchy. It's a hierarchy that's not built in. It's a hierarchy that we create through our own experiences. So you are what you eat, but you also are what you think. Our brain creates our thoughts, and our thoughts create our brain. And at the very top of this hierarchy are high-level issues like making judgments, which I think are inevitable. But you need a whole framework and perspective to make a judgment, and So these systems will make judgments based on different frameworks. Well, you know, from Lev Grossman's point of view, I would think this, but from John Hume's perspective, I would think something else, and so forth.
How much was the bet for?
Well, it's $20,000 with the proceeds to go to the charity of the winner's choice.
Right. Adjusted for inflation or just straight up?
The money actually has been put in and is earning income. So.
Right. You've talked mostly about the rise of artificial intelligence in terms of a positive scenario, but I just want to talk for a second about the alternatives. How much confidence do we have that if true greater than human intelligence were to arise, that they would be interested in helping us? How confident do we feel that they wouldn't say, you guys make awesome pets, but we're really tired of feeding you. We're going to put you down.
I think there were some movies along those lines, weren't there? Rings a bell. There's two answers. One is that promise versus peril has been an issue with technology since we've had tools. So fire cooked our food and kept us warm, but also was used to burn down our villages. A specter we have now is not AI run out of muck. It's not quite intelligent enough, but biotechnology is a danger. I think it's fantastically powerful in terms of what it can do. From a positive point of view, there are projects to reprogram biology away from cancer and heart disease and aging and other diseases. The same tools could be used by a bioterrorist in a routine bioengineering lab to reprogram a biological virus to be more deadly or more communicable or more stealthy and be a super weapon. And so I've written actually extensively about this. I wrote this about it in Age of Spiritual Machines. Bill Joy then wrote a famous cover story in Wired magazine, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, based on what I wrote in that. I wrote more about it. It's a chapter, The Deeply Intertwined Promise versus Peril of GNR and Singularities Near. Bill Joy and I actually wrote an op-ed piece, which was published in the New York Times, opposing the U.S. government publishing the genome of the 1918 flu virus, because we felt it was a recipe for destruction, which was the title of the piece. I was opposed recently to these biologists publishing their results on how to take a flu virus, which is very deadly in humans but not communicable, and show how it can be made communicable. I thought those should not be published. So anyway, this promise versus peril of GNR, which are the three main technologies we're talking about, G for genetics, which is biotechnology, N for nanotechnology, R for robotics, which is another word for artificial intelligence, is a very large issue. That being said, I don't see it as an us versus them. I see it as sort of us versus us. We have conflicts today among different groups of humans, and both groups of humans are enhanced with artificial intelligence already. You know, these are very widespread and ubiquitous, and it's really part of who we are. When Wikipedia went on strike, I felt like a part of my mind went on strike. And just because it's not physically in my body, I think when we actually do put computers in our bodies and brains, and some people are doing that, like Parkinson's patients, and there's lots of computerized devices being put inside people's bodies and brains already, but when that becomes routine, most of the action will still be out in the cloud, just like most of the action of this is in the cloud. It's not in the device. And I think it's a distinction without a difference as to whether or not it's in us or out. It is part of who we are. We are a human-machine civilization. You can't come in this room and say, okay, well, computers on the left and humans on the right, it's going to be all mixed up. It is already. Everybody here is enhanced with computer technology, and it's not really that different than what you find in Africa, even. But that being said, there are dangers to these technologies. We do have conflict among humans. I can make a different argument that the conflict actually has gone down. Steven Pinker makes this argument in a recent book. But we can't rule out ongoing war, and war can be more destructive as a result of these tools.
Do you think that governments or somebody should take a more active role in regulating the development of these GNR technologies?
Well, you know, the conflict's probably going to come from governments. So, so it's actually, I think, this group that should be very active in regulating. Look, and we all have the power to do that. Look at the SOPA situation. There was two interesting things, observations from that. One is, okay, here was this piece of bipartisan legislation, fairly rare, and it was headed smoothly towards confirmation. So Wikipedia, and it wasn't the leaders of Wikipedia, it was the user base of Wikipedia, got together and opposed it, and within hours, it was dead. I mean, just think of the political power of Wikipedia. It's breathtaking. Who thought of Wikipedia as a major political power? But it is. This ability to organize, and of course we see the impact of social networks, and I wrote about that in the 80s, that the Soviet Union would be overthrown by the social network emerging at that time. So we do have tremendous power through this decentralized communication. The other thing it showed is how much we are already integrated with these brain extenders, and the idea of it, of them being cut off, or even part of it being cut off for even a day, was actually disturbing. There was a workaround with the Wikipedia.
I think about this a lot, and a question I wanted to put to you was, when we talk about intelligence expanding, and we talk about our minds and bodies being enhanced by combining them with technology, are we just talking about intelligence expanding qualitatively, quantitatively, like adding processing power and expanding the body of knowledge that we can draw on, or does it change us qualitatively as well? Does it change the nature of that intelligence? And by that I mean human nature.
It's a great question, and we can find a really good example from the evolution of the neocortex. Mammals evolved and had a neocortex, which was the first time the brain could actually deal with hierarchies of information. And then there was a mass extinction event around 65 million years ago. And the old method by which animals would adapt is they would adapt over thousands of generations and change their characteristics. So they could learn and adapt, but it took, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And that was too slow, given the radical sudden change of climate. Mammals, which could actually learn things and communicate, survived, and it was at that point that they took over. And then the value of the neocortex was recognized by evolution, and it continued to expand. And it then expanded into the frontal cortex. We have a big forehead. That was the big innovation in humans. We also have an opposable appendage, a thumb, which works well. And an interesting thing about the neocortex is it's all basically the same. It uses the same algorithm, and I provide a lot of evidence for that. Just last week, there was evidence that in a congenitally blind person, the early parts of the visual cortex that process very basic letter shapes and curves and edges doesn't just sit there doing nothing. It actually starts processing higher levels of language, which shows that the levels in the neocortex that are dealing with humor and art and irony and satire and so forth are using the same hierarchical mechanisms as all the other regions of the neocortex. And that's why we see this tremendous plasticity. It's not that there's sort of simple functions that can recognize curves and lines and edges and then very complex structures that can deal with, you know, art and music. It's the same capability. Now, we uniquely are able to deal with these types of structures of art and science because we have more neocortex. It was a quantitative extension. We have about 300 million of these pattern recognizers. It's a lot more than the other primates. And that allowed for this qualitative change in the kinds of things we're capable of thinking of. That being said, 300 million is actually not quite enough. We'd like to extend it and think even bigger thoughts, and it will create even new qualitative changes. Why not a billion or a trillion little pattern recognizers in the neocortex? And so there's The extensions, we're not going to stuff them in our brains. They'll be out in the cloud. You can back them up. There'd be many benefits.
I do. I like the idea of backing up of consciousness. I want to stay on this for 1 second, just because when I think about my phone and the way I interact with my phone, and this may put me on the sort of slightly Luddite end of this room, I have a very ambivalent feelings about my smartphone. And like probably a lot of people here, whom I have observed, over the course of this conference, I spend a lot of time shuffling down the street, hunched over my phone, and I'm drawing on, you know, huge amounts of information that are stored elsewhere, and interacting with people who are somewhere else out there in the cloud. But I feel as though my experience of reality around me, and possibly my experience of the people around me, is correspondingly impoverished. It all starts to feel a little bit zero sum. And I guess my question to you is, how confident do you feel that we're not giving things up as we accept this technology into our minds and into our bodies?
So you've decided to go without any technology now for the future.
Well, I can't. This is a good question. And I will say, just because I can't stop doing it doesn't mean that it's good for me.
Yeah. I mean, Sherry Turkle has written about these disadvantages. I remember there was a big controversy that kids weren't going to learn arithmetic when the calculators came out when I went to college. And in fact, kids don't learn arithmetic. But the calculators haven't gone away. We have outsourced a lot of our personal, historical, social, cultural memories to the cloud and all the devices we use to access it. I think fundamentally it's a good thing in that it frees up what limited neocortex we have for more creative endeavors, which you can certainly see at this conference. I think actually we should reorganize education to teach teach kids by doing, have them actually do projects. If I think about what I managed to remember and learn, it's from the projects I did. And we see young people doing things, but they're not given enough freedom to do it. And there are resources you could bring to bear, like mentors. And so is there something lost? I think, you know, you really are in control. Time triage, it's one of the most important decisions we make every moment of our lives, what you choose to do. If you're on your phone or whatever, how you interact with the cloud, that's your own decision. You really can organize it the way you want. So people say, oh, well, people aren't as in touch with reality. I mean, it's reality out there, too. You're communicating with other people through these, and either directly through real-time social network communication or indirectly by reading things that have been written by other people, from work, literary works to instant messages. But you can decide how you're going to balance your time, and maybe that gets out of whack, but I think basically it has expanded our minds, and we still have a 19th century model of education. I think we should actually rely on this and teach kids how to solve problems, including the problems of the world, which high school kids and junior high school kids can actually contribute to.
I'm going to change gears for a second and bring up that Paul Allen essay. Some of you may have seen this a couple months ago. Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, published an essay called The Singularity Is Not Near. And one of the points he brought up was the law. He had a criticism of the law of accelerating returns. He argued that that law, it's a phenomenon that we have observed in the past, but because it is not a physical law, it's one of those things, as he puts it, that works until it doesn't. How much can we rely on it? How confident can we be that, for example, Moore's law won't simply hit a wall, and then everything will level off? Can it? Could it not just all stop?
Well, what I wrote was two things. First of all, most laws of science are not physical laws. They're based on the emergent properties of some lower level. Take, for example, thermodynamics, which predicts the future properties of a gas. And it actually does that by modeling all the particles as following a random walk. So by definition, it's completely unpredictable where this particle will be in 10 seconds. Yet by the laws, and they're considered scientific laws, of thermodynamics, you can predict the overall properties of the gas to a very high degree of precision. And the law of accelerating turns actually uses the same kind of mathematics. Now, when Paul Allen says it works until it doesn't, he's confusing a specific paradigm with the overall law of accelerating return. So there was a phenomenon where they were making vacuum tubes smaller and smaller, as I mentioned earlier, and that worked until it didn't. But what it then, as the end was near of that paradigm, it created research pressure to create the next method, which was transistors. And then the method after that was chips and Moore's Law. Moore's Law was not the first, but the fifth paradigm to bring exponential growth of computing. This exponential growth of computing goes back decades before Gordon Moore was even born. And yes, Moore's Law will come to an end, Gordon Moore said, 2002. Intel now says 2022. By that time, the key features will be about 30 carbon atoms in width, and we won't be able to shrink them anymore. We'll then go to the sixth paradigm, which if you speak to Justin Ratner, the CTO of Intel, will show you in his lab these circuits working already, which are three-dimensional computing. And the first, actually, three-dimensional chips have already come out. And that will keep this law of accelerating returns going for a long time. So I have an analysis of how long that can actually go with the sixth paradigm. It would be to a point where these technologies are trillions of times more powerful than the human brain at very low cost, which is why I think our brain extenders will be where the action is, just based on that sixth paradigm.
Has it been wrong? I mean, you've been tracking the curve for some time. Have there been things that you have predicted that have not come to pass?
Well, in terms of just predicting these basic underlying properties, such as price performance and capacity of different information technologies, they have progressed, and they go way back. In the case of computing, it's from 1890, and as I mentioned, I plotted that curve in 1981, and we're very much on that curve. I wrote predictions based on implications, social and, you know, product implications. Those are less predictable. I did an analysis, it's a 150-page analysis of the 147 predictions I made in The Age of Spiritual Machines, which I wrote in the mid to late 1990s, about 2009. 86% were correct. 14% were I marked incorrect. I was fairly strict about it. So, for example, that there will be self-driving cars. I marked it wrong because they're not ubiquitous, but the technology does exist. The Google cars have driven 200,000 miles without drivers. So I have a pretty good track record. The ones that are wrong tend to be ones like driverless cars, which are not just measuring the fundamental properties like instructions per second per dollar and things like that.
Second and last Paul Allen related question. He talks a lot about the complexity of the brain. And 2 years ago I was at the Singularity Summit, and I saw a very compelling presentation by the Cambridge neuroscientist Dennis Bray, where he talked about the kind of just dizzying, boggling number of different states and configurations that a single cell can take on as a way to encode information. And it was impressive. And sort of along those lines, Alan makes the argument that with existing / foreseeable future technology, hardware, and software, it's just not feasible to understand what's going on inside a brain and then secondarily to emulate it in silicon.
Well, there are 4 million quotations that Google will give you on the complexity of the brain. Okay, but I didn't contribute to that in this new book. Not that I'm saying it's simple. However, I mean, in that article, Paul Allen says every single structure and connection is there because of millions of years of evolution, and it's there precisely because of what you know, evolution has learned through millions of years. That cannot possibly be true, because that would, there are 100 trillion connections. That would mean there would be hundreds of trillions or quadrillions of bytes of design information. Where is that design information? The design of the initial state of the brain is in the genome. I have a whole analysis of this, but there's only 25 million bytes of design information for the brain in the genome. That's not simple, but that couldn't possibly describe every single connection. How does that happen? It's through massive redundancy. We have 300 million structures in the neocortex, which recognize a pattern and remember a pattern. They're organized in hierarchies, but that hierarchy is not specified in the design. It comes about entirely from our own experience. So what we actually choose to learn and interact with and the people we know, we are creating right now as we sit here new connections in our neocortex. And the complexity of it is quite manageable. I mean, that's a level of complexity that's quite in keeping with our advanced software systems. And I'd actually describe how that mechanism, which is repeated several hundred million times in the neocortex, works and provide the evidence for it. So if you look at something and you don't quite understand it and you see this incredible mass and tangle of connections and assume every connection was placed there by evolution based on, you know, its intelligent process, what it has done is create a very clever system that can wire itself based on its own experience. In the cerebellum, there's a mechanism repeated 10 billion times, and again, it is self-wiring. And there's massive redundancy. It's a level of complexity we can understand. He's kind of losing the forest for the trees and the branches and the veins in the branches. And you could say a forest is incredibly complex too, but in fact, there's a lot of fractal variability. You could say a tree is actually more complex than the whole forest. The actual information processing in the brain is understandable, and it is becoming revealed, and we are scaling up simulations based on these functional understandings of how the mechanisms work.
Just 5-minute warning. We're going to go to your questions. We've got 5 minutes on the clock. I want to repeat something that a fairly famous science fiction writer once said to me. I was talking to him about some of your ideas and the singularity, and he said that he agreed with almost all of your predictions about the future and how things were going to play out, with the caveat that he thought that the first immortal being on Earth was going to be a Mexican drug lord, and the second immortal being on Earth would be that Mexican drug lord's lieutenant, and that everybody else was going to have to pay. And I guess my question to you is, how confident do you feel that the kinds of marvelous AI-driven technological benefits that are on their way, how confident are you that they will be available to the 99%?
Well, you have to take a lot of comfort from how we've done so far. And I think, you know, where we are today is actually a good measure for a lot of these issues. 20 years ago, if you took out a mobile phone in a movie, that was a signal that this is a Mexican drug lord or some other very wealthy person of the power in the power elite. And they didn't work very well, and he didn't take it out of his pocket because it was big and heavy, and maybe it made phone calls poorly. Now that they do a million things, according to the Apple ads, they are very widespread and ubiquitous. There are 6 billion cell phones. About 1 billion of them are smartphones. Google projects 6 billion smartphones within 3 years. It really is in everybody's hands. And there's tremendous power that everybody has to create, you know, thousands of companies just represented here, and not just technological companies. I was at the music conference, National Association of Music Merchants, and it's like a computer conference with all the sophisticated gear to create music. Same thing for graphic arts or for library science. Every field is being empowered by these increasingly inexpensive yet very powerful tools. And in my view, that's part of who we are. We are the human machine civilization. We created these tools to extend our reach. Ever since we picked up a stick to reach a higher branch, we've extended our reach. And I think they will make their ways in our bodies, into our bodies and brains, but I think that's an arbitrary distinction. They are getting smaller. We're going to be more and more integrated with them. That's not to say there aren't dangers, but I actually don't see tremendous additional power being given to a small elite over the tremendous power that's in everybody's hands.
All right, last question. We've got 2 minutes until the Q&A. Say, there's so much change on the way. We're at this moment of such great volatility and flux. Say you're graduated from college right now. Where would you want to put yourself? What would you want to do to get yourself ready for the decades that are about to come?
Well, I touched on this before, and I think all of our schools, from elementary school on up, need to bring learn from doing into the curriculum, and not as some, you know, after-school extracurricular program, but as a mainstay of education. I started Singularity University with Peter Diamandis at the XPRIZE Foundation and support from Google and NASA. And entrepreneurship, starting projects to address world problems, is the centerpiece of the curriculum. So if I were a student, I would make sure I was able to do that and was at an institution that supported that and would provide both the time and the recognition and the mentorship to support that kind of thing. I think that is how education should work. Even if your project doesn't succeed, you'll learn a lot. It's the best way to learn, where you have a passion for some end result and suddenly you realize, whoa, I never realized math was that powerful. You can actually accomplish, you know, this mission I have for humanity with math, as opposed to just being this kind of boring subject. So as a student, I would seek that out. As someone interested in education, I try to foster that. My family's been actually involved with education since 1868, when my great-grandmother started the first school in Europe to provide higher education for girls. So that's my view.
Great. I think we're ready to go to the mic. All right, let's go to the mic. I'll sit here quietly, and Ray is all yours.
Great. My name is Michael Wang. I head up innovation at Georgetown University. The talk that you guys had struck a chord because yesterday my iPhone died, and out of sheer terror, I tried to hack it a little bit. So I got my little Kodak fun saver. I made a little contact list, and then I realized, you know, I didn't really need this. I realized sort of this the connectivity that I was craving, I found in the people around me. So I kind of marinated on that while you guys were talking. My question is, back to education, what are maybe three areas that you say, from an implementation standpoint, sort of pairing innovation with implementation, that we can, you know, implement at universities, knowing that we've been learning kind of the same way we have been for hundreds, even thousands of years, sort of looking at, is it competency, not looking at credits and courses? Sort of what are three things that you might say are actionable?
Well, first of all, in terms of fields of study, every area is relevant. So it's not that people have to be a computer scientist. The arts create knowledge, which is at the very top of our conceptual hierarchy and has also been amplified by technology. That being said, I think it's actually important for people to be computer literate, not just in using these devices, but actually understanding how computers work, even if you're primarily interested in the humanities as part of our current world. In terms of subject areas that are amenable to learn by doing, I mean, biology now, you don't have to have multi-million dollar labs with actually very inexpensive computing, very inexpensive equipment. You can do things like synthetic biology and other aspects of biotechnology. I think virtual reality and augmented reality is going to become part of our lives. Google's coming out with these augmented reality glasses. Whether that product succeeds or not is hard to say, but that's going to be reality Because devices are getting smaller and smaller, but people don't want to just look at a tiny screen. So why not this big screen that we see all the time? That's going to be our display. And we're going to increasingly interact in a fluid way without carrying around objects. The tools to create virtual realities and augmented reality is in everybody's hands. Just creating applications, the design tools are inexpensive. And people can then create applications that may relate to some other interest they have, which can be anything.
Hi, my name is Anil from KCRW. My question has to do with, well, thank you, first of all, for the super optimistic view of the world. I think it's amazing. My question has to do with the...
I did mention a few problems.
Yes, you did. My question has to do with the promise versus peril reality of technology. Does there exist, or should there exist, a moral code for people like the engineers and the scientists and the technologists that are harnessing these technologies to increase the promise and diminish the peril?
Absolutely. So 30 years ago, the potential abuse of biotechnology was recognized, and there was a conference, the Asilomar conference, to talk about it, and they came up with guidelines. So these guidelines have now been refined, and many of them are baked into law, the Asilomar guidelines for how to safely practice biotechnology, and any responsible practitioner knows them very well and follows them, and they've been very effective. There have been no, you know, significant accidents in biotechnology over the last 3 decades. So that is absolutely part of any program to protect against the downsides. There's a set of similar guidelines based on the Asilomar guidelines for nanotech, which isn't quite feasible yet in terms of self-replication. But that discussion's already underway. AI is a little more complicated, but there's discussions of similar ethical standards. In addition, you need to protect yourself against people who are not going to follow the ethical standards intentionally for whatever ideological reason. So actually, I started working with the Army, which is the agency in the United States responsible for bioterrorism protection, about 15 years ago, and when I got there, they gave me a tour, and they said, well, here's our section that deals with anthrax, and here's our section that deals with smallpox, and we've got some great smallpox samples. Would you like to see them? And I said, that's okay, some other time. And I said, what about dealing with a brand new virus you've never seen before that was created in a lab? And they said, oh, is that possible? So that was 15 years ago. Today, there is a rapid response system in place which will sequence a virus in a day. Another example of acceleration, because it took 5 years to sequence HIV, 31 days to sequence SARS. We can now sequence a virus in a day, create an RNA interference medication. I don't have time to describe the whole technique, but within days, a response could be developed. We had a big discussion, what about the FDA? That can take months to go through approval. The Army decided we don't need to go through the FDA. So, unfortunately, all of you do have to go through the FDA. But at any rate, those are the two main components. It's not a pat answer. I think this is the major challenge we have in the decades ahead.
Thank you.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi, I'm Bob Sawi. I'm curious to see or to know what you think how psychology and sociology is going to have to evolve or simplify as our life expectancies increase.
Well, we actually get used to these things very quickly. You know, social structures are changing. So I think sociology and psychology have an important role to actually track how society is changed by these technologies. People are already living longer and being productive longer. And it brings up a whole issue of resources, which you could spend a whole hour or a whole conference on. There's a good book by my co-founder of Singularity University, Peter Diamandis, called Abundance, which talks about how we're applying these same technologies I'm talking about to increase resources. We have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need, for example, to meet 100% of our energy needs, and the production of solar energy is doubling every year, 2 years. It's on an exponential rise. But it is changing psychological patterns. People can create communities now all around the world based on their common interests and concerns. So certainly politics has already dramatically changed. But as we basically literally change our minds and our brains, which I think we've already done, and that's going to continue at an exponential pace, examining the social and psychological impact is important, and there will be issues that come up that are short of existential risks, things like privacy and things like enabling bullying, which is a big issue now online, that we need psychologists to deal with.
Last question.
No pressure. Ray, I saw you, my name is Adam Lavelle. I saw you speak 2 years ago, and you were talking about how I could take a nanotech device, also known as a pill, and reconfigure my lungs to give me Olympic capacity, lung capacity. I just wanted you to talk about that for a second, and the tail end of that is there something I should be putting in my body other than what I've been putting in it here at South By that you would recommend? Thanks.
Could I have a list of those? You're referring to a design for a robotic red blood cell. I alluded to that very quickly, the ability to have nanobots in your bloodstream to keep you healthier. That particular one was designed by Rob Freitas and brings up an interesting observation about biology, which is that these robotic devices would be about 1,000 times more powerful than your normal red blood cells. So if you were to replace a portion of your red blood cells with these devices, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath or sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. So, honey, I'm in the pool will take on a whole new significance. ESPN said, we're going to ban these, right? And I said, I don't think we should, and I don't think we will. We should ban steroids because they're bad for your health. These are actually good for your health. So those are off about 20 years in the future. What you should do now is what we call Bridge One. I've written 3 health books, and we talk. My co-author and I talk about 3 bridges to radical life extension. Bridge one is what you can do right now. In order to get to bridge two, which is the full flowering of biotechnology, being able to reprogram the information processes underlying biology, that's really only about 15 years away, and it's already rolling out. For example, my father died of heart failure because his heart was damaged from a heart attack. Today, if you damage your heart in a heart attack, which half of all heart attack survivors have that condition, you can fix that with stem cell treatments. So these are actually rolling out already, but they'll be fully mature in 15 years. So we want to get from here to there in good shape. You know, if you're 20-something in good health, then I suggest you stay in good health and wear your seatbelt, avoid maybe the most extreme of sports. If you're a baby boomer like myself, my books are really a wake-up call to that generation. You can be in good shape in 15 years, but it requires a little more concerted effort. And so, again, it would be a long discussion as to what to do, but between nutrition and exercise and stress management and some supplements, depending on what your conditions are, you can be in good shape 15 years from now. And Bridge 2 will bring us to Bridge 3 and maybe another decade out of things like nanobots in your bloodstream, keeping you healthy from inside. I used to call that the killer app, but that wasn't a good idea for health technology. So,
good. Everybody? Ray Kurzweil.
Thank you very much.